New data points to racial disparities in coronavirus vaccine rollouts in the U.S. Blacks, Hispanics, and other ethnic minorities are receiving fewer doses. Germany adopts more strict measures, including travel bans, amid concerns over a surge in more contagious variants of the coronavirus. The people in Spain's Catalonia head to the polls for regional parliamentary elections that'll test the strength of pro-independence parties. Great pleasure to have you with us. Now let's start with the U.S. New data in that country is indicating that the country is struggling in racial disparities in COVID immunization. Blacks, Hispanics, and other ethnic minorities are receiving fewer doses of vaccines in Washington state. The data released by the state's health department suggests that just a quarter of Hispanics have received the vaccine, despite accounting for 13.2% of Washington's population. Among other ethnic groups that make up 4.3% of the state's population, just 0.3% have received the jab. By contrast, 66% of whites have been administered a vaccine so far. There have been similar reports from other states, including Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Mississippi, and Florida, suggesting that blacks are receiving vaccinations at dramatically lower rates than white Americans. As seen in analysis of five metro areas, including Chicago, Atlanta, and Houston, showed a similar trend against blacks and Hispanics. The U.S. Senate has voted to acquit former President Donald Trump, sparing him from conviction in a second impeachment trial in a year.
The Senate, having tried Donald John Trump, former President of the United States, upon one article of impeachment exhibited against him by the House of Representatives, and two-thirds of the senators present, not having found him guilty of the charge contained therein, it is therefore ordered and adjudged that the said Donald John Trump be, and he is hereby, acquitted of the charge in said article.
Now, the upper chamber of Congress voted 57 guilty against 43 not guilty. That fell short of the two-thirds majority needed to convict him. The former president was accused of inciting an insurrection on the Capitol last month while lawmakers were certifying Joe Biden as the next president. Despite his acquittal, a bipartisan majority cast votes found Trump guilty. In a statement, Trump, however, called the trial the greatest witch hunt in U.S. history. He said that his political movement has just begun. But Biden said that the substance of the charges against Trump is not in question, despite his acquittal. That was echoed by Senate Republican Mitch McConnell.
There's no question, none, that President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of the day. No question about it.
Textbook example.
Democratic Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer also slammed the vote to exonerate Trump as un-American. He said that the 43 senators who voted not guilty will forever be linked to Trump's terrible legacy. Democrats had warned that acquitting the former president would open the door for future presidents to violate their office in the final weeks of their presidency without suffering accountability. A short while ago, we're joined by Colin Campbell, our D.C. correspondent, who briefed us on the outcome of Trump's impeachment trial.
The Senate voted to acquit the president, the former president, and I think that was to be expected. This whole week, we've been listening to testimony from both sides and the widespread criticism of the former president's defense team as they cobbled together an argument that at times seemed rambling and unfocused, but at other times just seemed somewhat sophomoric, especially in the montage of the word fight, which was part of their defense. The whole time, everyone knew that the former president would be acquitted and that he would not be convicted There are only 7 Republicans who joined Democrats, far short of the 17 that they needed. And I believe that many didn't even think that they would get 7 at times. There was this argument that the former president couldn't be put on trial because he was not the president anymore, and impeachment was focused on presidents or people who are still holding office. But there was precedent that had already been set that not everyone who is found guilty to be impeached needed to be in office. But the Republicans largely did not want to believe that. They did not want to accept that in part of their decision making. And one could only think that it's mostly partisan, that they still wanted to show that they were in alignment with Trump, that they supported the Republican Party, and they didn't want to face a lot of their constituents who they would have a lot of questions to answer if they had voted to convict former President Trump.
UN Human Rights Rapporteur Elena Duan's visit to Venezuela has exposed the legal and devastating nature of U.S. sanctions against crisis in Venezuela. Caracas says that a UN diplomat's report accordingly describes the Latin American country's difficult situation and plans to take legal actions to improve that situation. Our correspondent reports.
During a press conference in Caracas, UN Human Rights Envoy Elena Duhan spoke about her preliminary assessment of her visit to Venezuela to evaluate the effects of the U.S. blockade against the Latin American nation. The UN diplomat said that the ongoing humanitarian crisis hitting the Venezuelan people is a direct effect of the sanctions imposed by the United States. She remarked her visit was based on UN standards of independence, impartiality, and comprehensiveness. Duhan added that the unilateral measures implemented against Venezuela, its institutions, and assets abroad violate international law. She added that the sanctions implemented by Washington and its European allies also violate the rights of the country to respond to the needs of a people suffering from the consequences of the blockade. In this context, Venezuelan Foreign Minister Jorge Arreaza pondered the statement of the high-ranked UN official.
As the UN rapporteur said, the U.S. sanctions are illegal and harm our country. So Caracas relies on the UN and many nations to legally fight against such sanctions.
However, some opposition figures blame the Maduro government for the sanctions.
The Maduro regime is being punished by the U.S. due to its refusal to hold free elections. So Maduro knows what to do to get the sanctions lifted.
But legal analysts say that U.S. sanctions cannot be justified by any means.
No country can meddle in the internal political affairs of another country, so U.S. sanctions are criminal and Venezuela will strongly resist against the aggression.
The UN official has described the effects of the illegal U.S. sanctions on Venezuela as devastating. Although Washington goes on imposing sanctions on the Latin American country, the UN diplomat urged the U.S. to stop its harmful measures. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
Germany has adopted more strict measures, including travel bans, amid concerns over a surge in more contagious variants of the coronavirus. Authorities have banned travel from Czech border regions and a state in Austria. 1,000 police officers have been mobilized to ensure strict border controls. The state-owned rail company also suspended services to and from the affected areas. In late January, Germany banned most travelers from countries classed as so-called mutation areas or places hardest hit by new, more contagious COVID variants. Well, those include Britain, South Africa, Brazil, and Portugal. Only a handful of exceptions are allowed to enter Germany from those countries, including returning Germans and essential workers such as doctors. Protesters have taken to the streets of the Austrian capital in defiance of a police ban to demonstrate against the government's COVID restrictions. At least 2 police officers were injured while they were attempting to disperse the crowd. Demonstrators say that they are against wearing face masks. They don't want their children to take mandatory COVID tests in schools. Omar Leski has more.
Protesters hold a huge rally in Vienna's city center defying a police ban on what's become regular rallies in Austria against the government-imposed restrictions to curb the spread of the coronavirus. Police put the official number of protesters at 2,000, but organisers said there were much more people, many of whom were forcefully barred from joining the bigger rallies.
Despite the police ban, thousands have been taking part in demonstrations like this over the past weeks. It looks like the arrests that have been made by the police during this time has done little to deter these crowds.
Many of the demonstrators said they were against the recently announced rule for older school children to take mandatory COVID tests and wear masks in school.
They have to test, they have to wear masks, they can't breathe and all this madness they have to do at school. And they have to stop now because they destroy actually our children. And the children, they are sick now in the brain because of all this madness going on here. And not because of the virus. They are sick because of the politicians.
Most of the protesters did not wear masks and were vocal in their dismissal.
There is no valid evaluation behind this that the government can say this is the reason when we do not use it that we get sick. And this is absolutely nonsense.
Local media said protesters included high-profile members of far-right and neo-Nazi groups. Several people were arrested and at least two police officers were injured. The government's management of the COVID crisis has also been criticised by industrial groups who argue the restrictions are killing jobs, growth and wealth. For now, with infections still high, the government has decided to keep hotels and restaurants closed while reopening schools, shops and services. Homolesky, Vienna.
Staying with Europe, people in Catalonia are heading to the polls for regional parliamentary elections expected to test the strength of the Spanish region's pro-independence movement. While those parties who are now in power in the region are competing with socialists who lead Spain's central government. Recent opinion polls indicate the socialists who oppose independence are slightly ahead. The vote is an important signal of an appeal by pro-independence groups and could affect the political trajectory of their movement. If separatists manage to retain control of the regional parliament, a new independence declaration appears quite unlikely due to division among parties. The turnout is expected to be low due to the coronavirus. Josiah Kedri says that the COVID-19 pandemic could affect the voter turnout in Catalonia's parliamentary election.
This election is happening in the midst of a pandemic. Even the elements seem to be against it. This is a very rainy day across the region, so that would be another element to take into account when people have to decide whether they will go out, show at the polls and vote, or stay at home. Some 5.5 registered voters are expected to cast their ballots today. The big unknown is how many of those registered voters will eventually show up at the polls. Polling stations have opened at 9 in the morning today, some with a delay due to one big handicap that's facing election officials, which is the lack of supervisors. Not all polling stations have supervisors. The situation is so critical that people, the supervisors themselves, fearing the fact that they may be infected, have preferred to stay home or to miss out on the election. The government has given a press conference a short while ago assuring people that they will be, that all the polling tables will be constituted before the end of this morning. That will remain to be seen. There are very, very strict measures in place.
10 years have passed since an uprising roared into life in Bahrain against an undemocratic regime. People in the Persian Gulf Kingdom still hold rallies, though sporadic, to make their voices heard and to condemn the ruling Al-Khalifa's crackdown on popular movement. Bahrainis seem adamant in their pursuit of reform on the anniversary of the 2011 revolution.
February 14, 2011 was the beginning of an uprising in Bahrain that brought tens of thousands of people to the streets across the tiny island to call for reform. But the peaceful movement soon turned bloody when the Al-Khalifa dynasty began to quell demonstrations with an iron fist. backed by forces deployed from Saudi Arabia in the early months of the uprising and mercenaries from other countries, the Bahraini regime launched a brutal clampdown. The heavy-handed response saw scores of people dead, thousands arrested, and many tortured in custody over years. The unprecedented suppression drew international outcries, but those outcries failed to stop a kingdom that hosts the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet.
The United States, of course, wishes to keep that Fifth Fleet over there because as a result of the Fifth Fleet, it is able to destabilize the region and terrorize people in the region. And so it serves America's interest to keep this regime in power so that America's Fifth Fleet can continue to operate from there.
Emboldened by foreign support, the Manama regime dissolved the main opposition party, Al-Wafaq, in 2016 and put its leaders behind bars. It also revoked the citizenship of hundreds of people, including prominent cleric Sheikh Isa Qasim. From the Iranian city of Qom, the 84-year-old spiritual leader marked the uprising anniversary via televised address.
With time, we can see that people have continued their uprising, and they continue to achieve their aspirations and their demands, and they have great aspiration in order to reach their demands, no matter how long it would take.
He said the uprising seeks to rectify the wrongdoings of the Al Khalifa regime. He noted that the Bahraini people want to take control of their own country. On the eve of the uprising anniversary, Bahrainis staged nationwide rallies, including in the capital Manama, and renewed their call for the downfall of King Hamad and his monarchy. The demonstrators also demanded that all political prisoners be freed. 10 years after the first wave of demonstrations rocked Bahrain, people are still hoping that their resistance would bring about democratic reforms, progress on human rights, as well as accountability for past and present abuses.
Yemeni doctors say that they cannot cope with the rising number of child malnutrition cases in that country.
Right now, cases of malnutrition are on the rise, more so than in previous years. Cases admitted daily have increased to between 4 and 5. There are several reasons for the increase in malnutrition, like the withdrawal of aid organizations. The health situation cannot cope. There are severe shortages in supplies, in the treatments needed, in examinations, and everything else. We ask the United Nations and other aid organizations to help lift the blockade as soon as possible.
On Thursday, 4 UN agencies warned that at least 400,000 Yemeni children under the age of 5 could starve to death this year. The world body also projected that a number of children under 5 suffering from severe acute malnutrition would rise by 22% this year compared to the year before. And that amid the Saudi war on the impoverished nation and the COVID-19 pandemic. The Saudi military action has pushed Yemen into what the UN has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Tens of thousands of Yemenis have died since Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on its southern neighbor in March 2015. And that brings us to the end of this broadcast.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 18, 2019 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz Uprising of February 18, 1978.
The revolution came and created a free atmosphere for criticism and reform. This has been the case throughout the past 32 years, even during the early years after the victory of the revolution. Before the revolution, the country totally depended on the West in science and technology. I have said this on many occasions before. Some parts of our military planes had been used up and had to be fixed, but they did not allow the engineers of the Air Force to take it apart and see what it was, let alone think of fixing it. They used to send that part to America by plane and bring another one instead. Or if one of the parts was supposed to be fixed, they used to fix it in America. There was no industry. Our industry was limited to simple assemblage without any innovations. After the revolution, scientific and national self-confidence was created in the country. We witnessed the emergence of so many scientists, prominent and great scientists in different fields.
Allah, Allah, la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, Allah, 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 la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah,
Allah, 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 Allah.
Today, there are very good scientists inside the country who have few equals in the world. Our scientists moved forward, and they were mostly young. Iran had no influence over global or even regional issues before the revolution. It had been humiliated. It did not have the slightest effect on different issues. After the revolution, the glory and greatness of this nation in the eyes of other nations across the world and its influence on regional issues have astonished the enemies. The enemies have been forced to admit this. Today, on foreign news websites, they are constantly speaking about Iran's influence and domination and its presence in regional issues. They admit this, though with hostile motives. Before the revolution, we simply imitated the West in cultural areas. But after the revolution, cultural invasion was recognized as a danger. There are many such topics. These are essential points.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
To Allah.
Iran's Islamic Revolution of 1979 was a monumental event in many aspects, with long-lasting effects still felt to this day. Let's take a look at how this movement, whose seeds were sown at the turn of the 20th century, sprung up and rose to defeat colonialism. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. To better understand the roots of Iran's Islamic Revolution, we have to go back in time to the beginning of the 20th century. This is when the British Empire was at its height, with around a quarter of the world's entire population under its rule and around a quarter of the Earth's landmass under its dominion. At this time, the British were occupying India, Australia, Canada, and vast swaths of Africa. One place that wasn't officially part of the empire, but in practical terms very much under its rule, is in fact Iran, with the Russian Empire occupying the northern part of Iran and the British exerting their sphere of influence over the southern part of Iran. Now, as with many imperialist endeavors, a lot of the story has to do with natural resources, particularly oil. In 1908, oil was discovered in Iran. A British company known back then as Burma Oil founded a subsidiary company called the Anglo-Persian Oil Company. This Anglo-Persian Oil Company installed its first pipeline just 1 year later in 1909 and built an enormous refinery in Abadan, which was completed later in 1912. And from that moment on, this company in Britain effectively began stealing oil from the Iranian people for the next decades. Former British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, at the time, was First Lord of the Admiralty and in charge of the British Royal Navy. He realized what a lucrative gold mine this was. He convinced the British government to buy an ownership share in the Anglo-Persian Oil Company in 1914, and he transitioned the Royal Navy's fleets from coal to petroleum, which proved to be of immense use in World War I and World War II, when the British Navy was the envy of other empires at the time. The British, however, took the Iranians for granted and gave them crumbs. Iran received a mere 16% of all oil revenue for its own oil. If that wasn't bad enough, this tiny amount of 16% was calculated by the United Kingdom's government in private without ever showing the Iranians the books. And on top of that, this was done after taxes had already been paid by the British government to the British government. This blatant theft and plundering of Iran's natural resources became common knowledge, and people rightfully resented the British and their colonial arrogance. Now, in the years after World War II, there was one politician who would soon put an end to this. His name was Mohammad Mossadegh. Mossadegh was known for wanting to nationalize Iran's oil fields, and just like many Iranians, held a grudge against the 1933 agreement made by Reza Shah, which gave enormous concessions to the British to continue plundering the oil at Abadan. Mossadegh was appointed prime minister in 1951, and soon thereafter, Iran's parliament moved to nationalize all of Iran's oil fields, including Abadan, which at this point, keep in mind, Abadan was the largest oil refinery in the world. That should give you an idea of how badly the British wanted to keep their hands on it. They opted instead to stop Iran from controlling and using its own oil refineries through means of sabotage and other clandestine operations. An embargo or blockade was also imposed on Iran to stop it from being able to sell its own oil on the global market. The British felt that they had been robbed somehow because they had discovered the oil, they had built the refineries, and they had developed Abadan. This is, of course, absurd, but the British would not accept this condition for long, and instead they resorted to the typical dirty tactics used by imperialists. They plotted a coup. The British called it Operation Boot. Meanwhile, the Americans, who were helping them, referred to it as Operation Ajax. The goal was to oust Mossadegh and reinstall the Shah and retake the oil. Now, while people often attribute the coup of 1953 to the CIA, and that's partly correct, the role of the British cannot be overlooked. We know, for example, that Mossadegh's chief of police, Mahmoud Afshartus, was kidnapped, tortured, and executed by Britain's Foreign Intelligence Service, MI6. Once this coup was completed and Mossadegh was deposed, the Americans and British moved quickly to help the Shah establish and train the SAVAK, Iran's secret police. The SAVAK were trained by the CIA, who had lots of experience training people in torture all over the world, in Jakarta, in Latin America, as part of their Cold War campaign against communists. Now, the CIA in training the Savak taught them how to repress dissidents, activists, and anyone who opposed the Shah. This is collectively remembered in Iran as a period of immense struggle and great suffering. The CIA did finally release documents titled The Battle for Iran, showing its involvement in the coup of 1953. The United Kingdom, however, to this day, maintains secrecy regarding the matter and has still not owned up or confessed to its damning role in the overthrow of Mossadegh. Joining me is Navid Zarinal, doctoral candidate and researcher at Columbia University. Thanks for taking the time to come on the show, Navid. It's a pleasure to have you.
Sure. Happy to be on the show, Richard.
So oil was one of the most lucrative things for the British Empire in Iran, and Mossadegh's nationalization represented a threat for them. What are some of the other things that aren't very much talked about, the other economic and political reasons for which the UK backed the Shah along with the US?
Yeah, that's a great question. And as you correctly say, the support of the UK for the Shah was based on oil, and Mossadegh wanted to nationalize the oil. So the British and to a lesser extent the Americans were upset about that, and they backed the Shah in opposition to Mossadegh. So that was one reason. But as the years went by, actually Iran got more concessions regarding sovereignty on oil. So a big reason, another reason that the UK and the US and also the West more generally backed the Shah was because the Shah was a big ally against anti-imperialist movements in the region and perhaps in the world at large. And also he was not a big annoyance when it came to the question of Zionism and Palestinian independence. And there's actually, I think, a good analogy to be made here to the SARS. So before the Russian Revolution, a lot of the anti-imperialist and progressive movements in the world were opposed to the SARS, the Russians. And in a similar way, in this period, so from 1950s onward to the present day, I would say a lot of the anti-imperialist movements are opposed to the US and the UK and the West more generally. And the Shah, since he was friendly to the US and the UK, he could be used as an instrument against these anti-imperialist movements.
Right. And a lot of people in Iran, they remember this period for its brutal repression. One of the most notable events, perhaps, is referred to as Black Friday. Can you maybe elaborate on that for us, as well as the secret police, the Savak, and just in general how political dissidents were treated and what the climate was like under the Shah?
That's right. So there were numerous demonstrations preceding the revolution, and there was one very famous protest known as Black Friday in English nomenclature. And it happened in what was called the Jalé Square at the time, and they changed the name after the revolution to the Martyr Square or Maidan Shohada. In this demonstration, the Shah's forces killed a number of people in this Black Friday demonstration, so it became a big event after the revolution that's remembered every year. Black Friday was an example of the wide variety of demonstrations that were happening. And also it indicated the high participation in the Iranian revolution, because if you look at the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution, or coming even more forward, the Romanian Revolution of 1989, the participation usually was about a couple percent. It wasn't very high. But in the Iranian Revolution, the estimates are that 10% of the population marched and actively participated in making their revolution. And regarding the second part of your question regarding the Savak or the secret police, so just as Shah security forces were on the streets containing the protests, the Savak would also gather intelligence, and they were also close to imperialist US, and they had a close eye on the activists and the dissidents. But what's interesting is that the Shahs generally gave more space to the Islamic dissent to operate, and they were harsher on socialist, Marxist, and leftist dissent. An example, I think this is a very powerful example of Shah's surveillance state and how his state would treat dissidents and revolutionary opposition. There was a program connected to the state. That was called Goftegu, which means conversation, and very similar to what you and I are having, Richard. there was a conversation between an anchor and a dissident who was in prison, and they would bring the prisoner on the show, and they were forced recantation. So the dissident had to recant on live TV. And there was one particular short story writer and cultural critic named Ghulam Hussein Saidi, who was tortured in prison, and then he was forced to come on this program called Guftegu, and there he had to recant the things like criticism of the Shah's government that he had made. And there's a very memorable line by a poet named Ahmad Shamlu about what happened to Saidi, because he also committed suicide eventually. And what Shamlu said is that what said, I'll read it to you, quoting Shamlu, what said farewell to Shah's prison was merely a half-living corpse. That man with his wondrous creativity after the bodily and mostly mental tortures of Evin prison became utterly lifeless.
Many in the West, especially the United States, when they think of the Iranian Revolution, they always see it through the lens of the hostage crisis, right? For example, this film with Ben Affleck, Argo, which they even won an Oscar for, you know, the whole Hollywood propaganda. Can you tell us why that's a faux lens to see the revolution through, and why this misses the bigger picture here?
That's right. It is a very U.S.-centric view to look at one of the biggest and most important revolutions of the 20th century. And as we discussed earlier, the real reason for a revolution was the imperialist support for the Shah that brought the crisis of legitimacy for the Shah. And then I think a reason might have been anxieties by the revolutionaries that, just as in 1953, the U.S. orchestrated a coup d'etat against Mossadegh, again, the U.S. could intervene in Iranian affairs. It's just a very minor event in the revolution, but from the American point of view, it became the event of the Iranian revolution. And as you said, it was represented in really terrible films like Argo. And if you actually look at the DVD cover, the Blu-ray cover for Argo, you see Ben Affleck looking very contemplative and rational, looking in the distance, but then the Iran revolutionaries almost look like zombies. They're holding things, and, you know, they're kind of, there's just a collective of them looking very scary and menacing, about to come and harm people. So it's interesting that even though Ben Affleck seems to be a nice anti-Orientalist, I mean, we saw in Bill Maher, he actually defended Muslims against Bill Maher's Islamophobia. But these kind of representations, when it comes to political difference, are still very much part of the American consciousness.
In the aftermath of the revolution, how did the West react, especially the U.S. and the U.K., both in the short term and in the long term, to try and undermine Iran after they suddenly lost control of their puppet monarch?
So I think the attempts to sabotage the revolution started from early on. I mean, I think we can look to the example of the Iraq-Iran war as a very unfortunate war that was devastating for both countries. And I think the West was using Saddam Hussein as a way to weaken and sabotage the revolution. But I think even the bigger attempts to sabotage the revolution came through such things as a currency sabotage. So since Donald Trump withdrew from the nuclear deal, Iranian currency has collapsed, and that makes it very difficult to actually bring foreign imports in. And also the effect of sanctions. The problem is that when Iran has a difficult time transacting in the international banking system, it's very difficult to get medicines in. But what's, I think, really important to keep in mind, that despite the American attempt to sabotage the Iranian revolution, Iran has a very strong national production industry, and that has allowed it to withstand the American so-called maximum pressure.
Speaking more broadly, what are the main anti-imperialist values and lessons that the revolution brought with it, and how have they permeated in Iranian society and remained throughout the last four decades?
I would say a big value of the Iranian revolution is that it's providing an alternative to the globalization that is led by the U.S. and multinational corporations that I'm speaking of, is that there's a uniformity in our taste in leisure, in our economic choices, in our political models. So everything is becoming uniform. But the thing about Iran is that when people travel here, they actually see the political and economic difference here. So I think the political model is very different. Theocratic democracy is what I would describe it as. And the thing is, because our cognition, our political cognition, is so Eurocentric, we see that as an oxymoron. But the thing is, I think they can be reconciled, just as you can reconcile equality and liberty under liberalism. I think it's very doable to reconcile theocracy with democracy. And I think that's also an interesting Iranian experiment, an alternative to the European models that have been universalized since colonialism. So even though you do have things like class inequality, and one of the biggest aspirations of the Iranian revolution was class equality, but unfortunately that has been much more difficult to achieve. But despite this, there is still an alternative to the globalized neoliberal model that the US and multinational corporations are pursuing. And you see that, I think, when you travel here. And I think a second important value and legacy of the Iranian revolution has been the support for the Palestinian cause. And I actually see this as an ideological and also moral commitment to Palestine and the Palestinian people. And that was an early aspiration of revolution that has persisted to the present day.
When we talk about the axis of resistance, you know, we talk about Iran, Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Palestine, and Iran has supported all these various resistance movements, and actually not just in the Middle East, but even with Venezuela, this partnership and alliance. Can we argue that this is very much indeed one of the main values spurred on by the revolution? And how is it that Iran has become this backbone of these anti-imperialist efforts?
The support for resistance to imperialism is definitely a value of the Iranian revolution that we see both in ideology and in a state practice. And again, I think, I mean, it definitely has a geopolitical element to it, but I think a big part of it is ideological, philosophical, and ethical. And I think, as you correctly mentioned too, it's not, you know, because, you know, in the Western media, the representation is that whoever is Shia, Iran just supports them, so they turn it into a sectarian issue. But as you mentioned, I mean, Venezuela, I don't think they have too many Shias, but Iran is a big supporter of Venezuela. So I think it's an ideological and ethical commitment against imperialism, and because of this, they are supporting a resistance movement against imperialism. And it's not easy to do. It comes at a big cost to the country, for example, the sanctions, but it is something that the Iranian revolution is committed to.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
After the coup in Iran in 1953, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company changed its name to something that many of you are familiar with, British Petroleum, or BP. And when the U.S. carried out another coup the following year in Guatemala to depose of the democratically elected President Arbenz, another multinational was also at the heart of this dispute, United Fruit Company. And they also rebranded and changed their name afterwards to Chiquita Brands International. Now, while these corporations change their names and try to rebrand, the tactic remains very much the same, and we continue to see a lot of the same covert means and clandestine operations being used by the United States and the United Kingdom to overthrow other governments just for the sake of stealing their resources. As they say, war is a racket. Now, when the Islamic Revolution came about decades later, this changed everything and shocked the world. All of a sudden, the Shah, a puppet monarch loyal to the West, was overthrown and replaced by an Islamic Republic that was opposed to the West and to Israel. But it's important to note that this didn't happen overnight. Protests and movements to oppose the Shah started already in late 1977 and grew steadily with a coalition of students, leftists, Islamists. This broad coalition is a very important factor to which the success of the revolution can be attributed to, and shows the plurality of the uprising by the Iranian people against the Western-backed monarchy. hundreds of thousands of Iranians, millions in fact, took to the streets in mass protests, prompting the Shah to declare martial law and impose a curfew. This repression became especially violent during this period, with one of the most horrific moments being the fire at Cinema Rex, which was, quite frankly, a terrorist attack, with over 400 people burned to death inside of a movie theater by four men working under orders of the Savak, the secret police. Another instance referred to in English as Black Friday was at Jaleh Square, now named Martyr Square, where the Shah's troops gunned down hundreds of protesters. It would only be a matter of months in January of 1979 until the Shah would leave Iran like a coward, pretending that he was going on vacation. He actually never returned. He stayed there in exile until his death. Shortly thereafter, Imam Khomeini finally returned to Iran on February 1st of 1979, greeted by jubilant crowds after spending 15 years in exile. In fact, over a million Iranians flocked to the streets in a show of support. Widely regarded as both the spiritual and the de facto leader of the revolution, an Islamic Republic was established through a national referendum and the adoption of a constitution under Imam Khomeini as Iran's first leader. And this marked the beginning of a whole new era for the nation. Finally, after decades of rule under a Western-backed puppet sponsored by the US and the UK, Iranians had now finally reclaimed their country by taking to the streets in the millions, voting in a new constitution and establishing a new Islamic Republic. And of course, with that said, Iranians, of course, regained sovereignty not just over their nation, but also over their natural resources, including the oil, which the British had plundered for so long. So, again, when we talk about the Islamic Revolution of 1979, it's really important to also talk about the history behind it, about the role that the United States and the United Kingdom played in the coups in 1953 by installing the Shah, who betrayed his country's riches to these multinational corporations and brutally repressed the Iranian people. This is a very, very important part of history that many Americans and many British do not understand, let alone know of. They have hardly any clue of the atrocities, the countless coups, interventions, the meddling, and all the nefarious covert operations that their governments carry out all across the world in their names. From their point of view, Iranian history starts in 1979, and that's all they know, and it's completely awash with anti-Oriental propaganda which seeks to demonize Iran. The truth is that Iran's revolution represented a landmark moment, the awakening of a movement, and the will of the people to fight and regain their sovereignty from the West. This caused a huge upset for Western governments and the multinationals that run them behind the scenes. In reality, Britain and the United States don't want other countries to be democracies. They want other countries that they can control, both politically and economically. Only then are those countries considered allies. You know, when nations like Iran, who are not only resource-rich, but rich in culture and history, actually stand up for themselves, it is extremely embarrassing for the suits in Whitehall and Capitol Hill who think that they are above everyone else. Iran's Islamic Revolution wasn't just an upheaval of Iran's political climate, it was also an act of defiance and an act of anti-imperialism. This idea of standing up to oppressors is something that is very deeply ingrained in Iran's culture, and this is not just something we see internally, but also internationally. Iran has been an ally and helped to liberate my country of Syria from the various jihadist groups and the scourge of foreign terrorists that once again Britain and the United States have financed along with Saudi Arabia and others. And equally, since the revolution, Iran has helped Lebanon and Palestine in their resistance against the Zionist occupation and in the protection of their lands. And more recently, we see in Iraq and Venezuela how Iran has helped these nations stand up against foreign invaders and imperialism. This is very important for people to understand, and it also explains why the West has held a grudge against Iran ever since it broke free from Occidental rule, seeking to cripple it always with sanctions, with war, with intimidation. Now, not just because Iranians took back control of their country, but also because they outmaneuver and help other resistant movements regionally and globally, and help other people stand up for themselves. Sure, there's no such thing as a perfect country or a perfect political system in the world. But there is something to be said about a nation and a people that are brave enough to stand up to tyranny, to colonization, to white supremacy, and then help their brothers and sisters elsewhere to do the same. It is a remarkable feat of resistance and anti-imperialism, and why Iran continues to be a thorn in the side of those oppressors who seek to colonize the Middle East. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, the world is a market. This world is neither man's main home nor his permanent residence. Rather, it is a great house of commerce to which man is sent. He is given a capital in the form of his lifespan, physical and mental powers, guidance and intelligence, so that he may use these to accumulate valuable provisions to take back for his eternal prosperity and everlasting life. Those who are active, diligent, vigilant, hardworking, and far-sighted know the tricks of this great commerce. They do not relent for a moment. They are always on the lookout for opportunities to trade their temporary worldly goods to earn precious heavenly goods, merchandise with an eternal shelf life and a bright destiny for themselves as well as their society. Unlike the losers, they do not spend their capital on futile, transitory, and destructive worldly pursuits, which result in leaving the world empty-handed. So there are two types of people. One are good investors, the other are not so good or poor investors. Poor investors invest their capital in poor investments. Those who are wise, those who are smart, those who are intelligent investors, they make sure that whatever they invest their capital in has to be result-bearing. And these are the believers. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the topic of the world is a market, and we are sent here with some capital. One of those capitals is our life. The other is our physical and mental powers, the guidance and intelligence. All of these are the capitals that we have been sent to this world with. Now, if we are smart and intelligent investors, we would know where to invest all this. But if we are out of those dumb ones, then rest assured we are going to waste this capital. Imam Hadi alayhi salam has said, "The world is a market in which some gain and some lose." Now again, brothers and sisters, who are those who gain and who are those who lose? Look at the history. Look at the lives of prophets and imams. Look at the guidelines and instructions of Quran. You would know where to invest your capital. At a macro level, there are three types of human beings. One considers this world to be everything and a permanent abode. The second type considers this world to be meaningless and don't work hard in this world. They simply waste their lives and resources and their capital. Number three, the third type knows the reality of this world and knows that they are not going to live here forever. Their souls belong to somewhere else. They have come from somewhere else and are headed towards somewhere else. These are the believers. They do not waste their capital, their time, their energies, their resources, their capabilities, their, you know, investments in this world on futile things. They're the ones who are God-weary, who know exactly where God wants them to spend their energies. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The U.S. detains oil ships is the slogans chanted by protesters in a rally held in front of the United Nations office in Sana'a. The protesters condemned the continued detention of oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition and